they're like using their shoes to scoop up the slightly damp mown grass and trek their feet everywhere. But it's a fairly impressive height to climb, isn't it? So I hope the health and safety, hope the health and safety officer is out there sorting it.
It
is, but it's quite impressive that they climb so high too.
They're just too young to do that.
They'll sort them.
What if they fall down?
That's what those guys are out there fixing, so it's all right. It's okay, yeah. Yeah, he's all right. They're all right. Yay! They're back. Back on terra firma. Okay, throughout the Bible, there are many poignant and pithy verses that we hear over and over. And you know the kinds of things are the ones they make the little Christian gifts out of. So from key rings to photo frames, from diaries to cups, you can be reminded of some special message. Some people love them. Some people think they're a little bit kitschy. That's all right. It's personal opinion. And in other literature, they become the quotes that we remember from something we've read. So you must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. From Pride, Mr. Darcy. Even without Rochelle, we got it. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Dickens, Tale of Two Cities, yep. Though she be but little, she is fierce. Yeah. Shakespeare. And they make the gift wear too. My brother bought that back for one of my girls. They're fierce. Don't tell them I said that. And these quotes are meaningful because of the beautiful language that we're drawn to, or because of the sentiment that they express, or maybe the memory that they hold, or for the truth and encouragement they bring us. And the passage that Liz has read today for us from Esther has one of those verses in it. Last week, Steph began introducing us to the cast of characters in the Book of Esther and the setting that they find themselves in. I think we were all shocked, as Deborah said, as we listened to Kathleen reading so beautifully the words of the first couple of chapters of Esther. We were surprised by the brutality of the world, the domination of men over women. And while it feels so different from the world we experience, we heard stories that are happening today when women and girls are brutally sold as property. And I'm sure many of us have spent some time this week reflecting on the story with fresh eyes. And I remember Esther, when I was a kid, Esther was one of the stories that I would read, partly that it was a story of with a woman as a central character, I think. I also read Ruth, but I liked the kind of fairy story, queens and kings maybe a bit of the adventure. I used to read David and Bathsheba too. I used to find that and read that from time to time, which does make me ask serious questions about my reading choices and my ideas of romance. But I did love a good romantic story, and I think a conversation for another time on what constitutes a good romance needs to be had. Anyway, last week we met the fumbling Xerxes, the subtle Esther, and the resolute Mordecai. And this week, the story introduces us to a menacing Haman who is out to get anyone who doesn't treat him with the respect he thinks he deserves. Mordecai particularly seems to get at Haman's craw, and this results in Haman planning for the destruction of all the Jewish people. The final part of chapter 4 involves a conversation passed between Mordecai and Esther, where he says the line that I want to focus on today. Mordecai says that Esther's naive if she thinks that she won't be found out to be a Jew and face the same destruction as the rest of the Jewish people by Haman. Mordecai is sure that help will come for the Jewish people from somewhere. But then he wonders if she has her place in the royal household for just a time as this, or such a time as this. Have you ever been told that, or have you ever thought that? That idea that I am here for such a time as this. We often hear it used by people to help people try and understand the suffering that someone is experiencing. Maybe God will use this suffering to help someone else. My mind immediately flicks to someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who had to gather his courage and the strength of his convictions to put into action his plan to try and kill Hitler And I wonder if someone had said it to him or one of his co-conspirators. I've been thinking a lot about this phrase for such a time as this, and I think it can be used in helpful and unhelpful ways. There is a beauty in the words. They are inspiring. It is like saying, I am the right person for the task. I guess we could use it as inspiration to persevere through a difficult situation, and that could be helpful. Mordecai that implied that it was part of God's grand plan that Esther would be able to use her role as the queen to make a difference on behalf of the Jewish people. But there are a couple of ways that I see these words as being unhelpful and that they can become weaponized for the receiver. The first, I think, is that we can see it as only being about something grand and magnificent. As I said, I imagine Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You might imagine someone else who, when faced with an extraordinary circumstance, gathered their courage and made a brave and faith-filled choice. And I was talking to Liz over this last week, and we were talking about this line, and Liz reminded me of a song that we used to sing, 90s, 80s, 90s, 80s. Do you remember, I Have a Destiny? I have a destiny I know I shall fulfill. I have a destiny in the city on that hill, on a hill. I have a destiny and it's not an empty wish, for I know I was born for such a time as this. Long before the ages you predestined me to walk in all the works you have prepared for me. You've given me a part to play in history to help prepare a bride for eternity. I did not choose you, but you have chosen me and appointed me for bearing fruit abundantly. I know you will complete the work begun in me, by the power of your spirit working mightily. And then you go back to, I have a destiny. Who remembers singing that? However, I think that maybe each of us here are in this moment for such a time as this. Maybe not for a grand and magnificent thing that will focus the world and change the entire world around us. We're called in our ordinary ways, in our ordinary everyday lives, to try and faithfully follow God. It can be as simple as how you treat the staff at the supermarket or other cyclists or motorists on the road, which my girls would have something to say about me sometimes. Micah's words that we are to love mercy, live justly, and walk humbly with our God. It's not only for the brave and magnificent moments, but for each and every moment. So yes, we are here for such a time as this. But maybe it will reveal itself in an ordinary, everyday moment, just through our lives. The second way I see this phrase as being unhelpful is that when it is offered to someone who is suffering, there is a suggestion that God is moving chess pieces that are our lives around a board from a distant place in the sky. That if I can faithfully go through this suffering, then God will be able to bring something good out of it for someone else. And this has a little ring of truth to it, but I think that if we sit with it for a bit, and especially if we are told like something like this in the midst of our suffering, we end up seeing that we have a picture of quite a mean and conniving God. And I definitely want to step away from that. I don't think there's a reason that's good enough that makes it someone's suffering okay or even God's plan. There are definitely gifts that come from our experiences of suffering. But I would argue that that's not a good enough reason for God to organize our suffering. It takes me and my story to our son William who died. And yes, I'm probably a more compassionate person, probably more able to empathise with people who are suffering, but that is and will never be a good enough reason for him to die. I'd rather be crotchety and have him here. It's not the words themselves or the story of Esther that are the problem. It's how they can be offered to a person who is suffering. Kate Bowler is one of my favourite writers. She's a history professor at Duke Divinity School in North Carolina, who, while researching and writing her book called Blessed, A History of the Prosperity Gospel in America, she was diagnosed with stage 4 bowel cancer. She was 35 and had a 1-year-old son. I remember reading Blessed for a paper I was doing and also reading her New York Times op-ed called Death, the Prosperity Gospel in Me. You can look it up, it's a good read. What a combination, being diagnosed with incurable cancer and being an expert on the gospel that purports that Jesus came to give you money and a good long life. Her next book was called Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. And it tells the story of her diagnosis and treatment. She has a particular issue with easily trotted out phrases that can be used to brush over the suffering someone is experiencing. She tells the story that after her diagnosis, someone came over to bring a casserole, and she gives it to the casserole to her husband and says, "Oh well, everything happens for a reason." And her husband, who Kate Bowler says is usually very mild-mannered, says, "Really? Well, I'd love to hear it then." I know the person was just trying to step lightly and probably didn't know what to say, and it was just sort of poured out in an uncomfortable moment. But words can be brutal and can take us into really difficult spaces. And one of the things Kate Bowler does in her speaking and podcasting and writing is to try and help us find language to say to each other that helps us to stand together, to support each other when everything goes to custard. This saying, for such a time as this, has the ability to brush over the suffering and pain that imply that your misery is part of God's amazing plan. And do we really want to say that to someone? She suggests better things to say to someone who is suffering is, "I am so sorry, that is so hard." Or, "I don't even know what to say, but I'm here." And I think that Debs had showed us a beautiful picture when we reflected on communion and on the cross and life and suffering of Jesus, that God is present with us in our suffering. Suffering is part of this world. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. It's part of, we live in a world that is broken. And suffering is a real part of it that we all experience in one way or the other. And we have a Saviour who knows what it is to suffer, who knows what it is to experience the depth of human pain, and who went through it. And we also know, like Debs also said, we have the hope of a God who has beaten death, who does not give it the final word, and that one day, someday, somehow, is working to make all things new. So as I reflect on this part of the story, I see that we're all here for such a time as this. We're all learning to be followers of God, walking humbly, learning to love mercy and to live justly more and more. And I pray that we have a sense of God with us in the midst of our suffering through this week. Amen.